WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
Today we remember Paul Burleson. In the mid-1950s, he teamed up with Johnny and Dorsey Burnett to form the Rock and Roll Trio. They were one of the first bands to play rockabilly, a fusion of country music and rhythm and blues that formed the sound of early rock and roll. Burleson is credited with inventing the fuzz, or distorted guitar sound, that later became a hallmark of rock. The Rock and Roll Trio was one of the wildest, most unhinged bands of the time. They were a major influence on many later bands, such as the Yardbirds and Led Zeppelin. When the Rock and Roll Trio broke up in the late 50s, Burleson retired from music and ran a successful construction company. During the 80s, he would sometimes tour with an oldies group called the Sun Rhythm Section. In 1997, he released his own album. Paul Burleson died last weekend of cancer. Terry spoke with him in 1987. Before we hear their conversation, this is the Rock and Roll Trio playing The Train Kept A-Rollin', recorded in 1956.
City, and we trucked on down that old fair lane with a heave and a hoe. Well, I just couldn't let her go. Get along, sweet little woman, get along. Better be young when you're away, you get along. Sweet little woman, get along. Better be young when you're away, you with a heave and a hoe. Well, I just couldn't let her go. Well, the train kept a rolling up on that hill.
Well, that guitar will give you a sense of how my guest Paul Burleson sounded in the mid-1950s when he was part of the Rock and Roll Trio. Now, you started off playing country music and ended up playing rockabilly. What was the transition like? Do you remember things subtly changing in there?
Well, actually, we was going from country and a little blues and doing a little western swing music back in those days in the early 50s until Elvis came on the scene. And after that, well, everybody just kind of got on the bandwagon and started doing this that type stuff.
What did it mean for you in your guitar playing louder, faster?
Well, I was kind of playing. I was trying to just I had free choice. I could do anything I wanted to do. We didn't have any kind of arrangements, anything. So we just kind of tried to do anything that sounded different or come up with anything that sounded that had a pretty good sound to it. So if it sounded good, we just used it. And that particular song right there, well, it just. I've been doing that thing for several weeks before we recorded it and liked that, and so everybody liked it, so that just we just used it.
You had a reputation for being a pretty wild band. What were some of the things you'd do on stage?
Oh, I would lay down on my back and play guitar, you know, get on my knees, you know, and stuff like this. I chewed gum all the time, you know, even on national television, I chewed gum and stuff like that. And I guess they thought it was a little wild back in those days. I guess it was.
Now, you got your start on the Ted Mack Amateur Hour when the band went to New York trying to make a name for itself. It ended up as, I think, three-time winners on Ted Mack. Now, I remember that as this very sedate program with basically young vaudevillians, you know. What did you do on the show?
We just played rockabilly music. We did one of Chuck Berry's songs, Maybelline, first night, I think. Then we did another up-tempo type song. Then I think we did Blue Suede Shoes for the third week. And that was just rockabilly music. To us, it was just about all we was doing at that time.
That helped you get a recording contract.
With Coral.
When you were in the studio, I'm sure that a lot of the engineers and producers weren't really used to the kind of music you were playing.
No, they really didn't know what to do with us. They had a 32-piece orchestra at our first session at New York City at the Python Temple. And the orchestra leader came over and told us, now, boys, we don't know anything about this rockabilly and rock and roll stuff. Said, you tell us what to do, and we'll be glad to do it, you know, background and everything. And we just laughed at them, you know, told them we didn't know what we was doing either. We just did what we felt like doing and played the way we felt. So they said, well, is there anything that you can use in the group? So we used this drummer. And actually, he didn't even play on his drums. He played on his cases.
Really? Why did he do that?
Well, he was sitting down on the end of the stage, and I couldn't hear him, and I kept telling him to play louder. And he says, if I play any louder, I'm going to break the heads on my drums. And I said, well, I still can't hear you. And so he said, well, I'll get my cases over here. So he brought his cases over there, and he played on the black plastic cases. And that's what you hear on Tear It Up. Yeah, it was, his name was Eddie Grady.
Let you give us an idea of how loud you were all playing.
You're right.
So did you tell that 32-piece band basically to get lost, that you didn't need
we
them?
We told the leader of the band that we didn't need any of the rest of them, so he dismissed everybody else, and so they all left.
You basically invented the fuzz guitar sound.
Well, I've been accused of it, but I dropped my amplifier. It happened as an accident, really. I was right here in this town. We was playing here in Philadelphia with the Four Aces and some more groups, and I was walking down the hallway, and the strap on my amplifier broke, and the amplifier fell to the floor. I picked it up, put it under my arm, carried it out on the stage, plugged it in, and didn't know that it, you know, what had happened, you know. So they introduced us, they opened the curtain, the announcer came out and introduced us. I started playing, it sounded fuzzy. And so Johnny looked around at me, and I looked back at him, and we just kind of smiled at each other, and I shrugged my shoulders. And after the thing was over, the show was over, then we went backstage, and I took the back off of it and looked to examine what had happened, looked at all the wires, and I thought maybe my speaker was busted, but it wasn't. What had happened, one of the tubes that dropped down was acting as a rheostat, like a dimmer in your dining room or something, so it was delaying the sound going through there. So I pushed the tube up, and it worked fine. And I forgot about it for several weeks later. We was at Nashville, and I told Owen Bradley at the barn where we recorded this album. And then we were just fixed to do a record Train Kept Rolling. So that's why it's on Train Kept Rolling, the fuzz. And then we did Honey Hush right behind it. I pushed it back up in the amp, and that's the last time I ever pulled it down record.
What made you think that you liked this sound that was caused by a defect in the amplifier?
I didn't really protect, well, I liked it a little bit, but I didn't know that it was going to create a big stir or anything, you know, until engineers started calling me at the motels, asking me, what am I doing on this thing? What are you getting that sound on this song? And so I just told them, you know, I told them what happened, you know, that it was, you know, just a loose tube. And the thing, some people, then there's a lot of people said that I couldn't took razor blades and split my speakers and stuff like this, but I never did splitting speakers. That's the only thing that ever happened.
What happened when you got a better amplifier and you couldn't loosen the tube? How were you able to recreate the sound?
I never did recreate it. I never did. After that, it was just a little Fender Deluxe amplifier and never could recreate the sound. But the little old amplifier, you could do it if you had a little Fender Deluxe amp. That's the only one you could do it on. And the third tube over from the back, looking at it, you had to get it just right. You had to wiggle it to get it just right. You couldn't just pull it down, the tube down. You had to kind of wiggle it to get it, make it sound fuzzy, till you hit the strings of the guitar to make it sound fuzzy.
There's, I'm sure, a lot of great stories about how you met the Dorsey brothers. You were all boxers. You were, I think, the welterweight champion of Memphis when you met?
I was the open welterweight champion of Memphis when I met Dorsey. It was 1949. In January or February of 1949. And I was playing on a radio program there in KWEM, West Memphis, Arkansas. And I played an instrumental that day, and Dorsey heard me playing on the radio. And when he sat down beside me at the auditorium that night for the boxing matches, he said, "You're Paul Burleson." I said, "That's right." He said, "I'm Dorsey Burnett." We shook hands with boxing gloves on. He had his on, I had mine on. He was a novice welterweight. I was an open welterweight. And he said, my brother and I, we play music, said, well, let's get together sometime and pick some. And I said, okay. And he said he liked what he heard, and he said, I'd like for you to hear me and my brother play. And I said, let's get together. I said, okay. But it was a year or two later before we finally did get together.
I guess people didn't mess with you knowing you were all boxers.
Not too much.
They can clean the house.
the ones around Memphis didn't mess with us too much. Maybe on the road sometimes, you know, somebody might say something, but we could take care of ourselves pretty good. I mean, but if somebody got on one, then of course you had to whip all three of us, you know. And we did know how to take care of ourselves, but we didn't really go out starting trouble at all, really. We didn't go out and try to take advantage of it just because we knew how.
Why did the band split up?
When did it split up?
Why did it split up?
Well, Dorsey and Johnny, both of them were singers, and both of them had good voices, and they could both put on good shows. And Dorsey, he wanted to branch off on his own and become a singer, and he was tired of playing the bass, and so he branched off and went off on his own in the middle of 1956. And then in the fall of 1957, I got tired, just exhausted. And I was tired of being away from my family and missing my children. And so wasn't nothing really happening big, so I just quit.
Did you miss it a lot? Because you started your own electrical contracting company, different life than in rock and roll.
I missed it very much. And in fact, I had to get the guitar and that far out of my sight for a couple of years to really get it out of my system, you know. And so after that, then it was really hard on me because after I started, I was really having a rough time with the electric company to get it off the ground. And, you know, when you start a new business, it's really tough. It was for me. And it was real tough. And then right at that time, well, they was having hits right after the other, right at that time. Mm-hmm. Dorsey had Tall Oak Tree, a big hit. And then Johnny came out with Dreaming and You're 16. And I was struggling right at that time. And it was really hard because they was calling me all the time, asking me to, come on, man, come on back. You know, we'll cut you back in as a third just like you was, you know, and everything. And come on out here, California, you know, you don't need to be up there. And but I said I couldn't do it because I didn't have anything to do with that, you know. I said I didn't have anything to do with it, and I couldn't come out there because I feel like I was a handout or something, you know. Mm-hmm. I said I got to do something on my own. So I stayed at home and just dug in and really – I made my electric company a success, and I'm really glad I did now, because it's meant a lot to me.
Paul Burleson spoke with Terry Gross in 1987. He died last weekend at the age of 74.